crowds surged, carrying plastic bags, pushing buggies and dragging toddlers. "She's in Southwest General. She's been there a week. She's had a stroke."
"She's been there a week,"
said Crystal, her stomach still swooping.
"Nobody told us."
"Yeah, well, she can't speak properly, but she said your name twice."
"Mine?"
asked Crystal, clutching the mobile tightly.
"Yeah, I think she'd like to see you. It's serious. They're saying she might not recover." "What ward is it?"
asked Crystal, her mind buzzing.
12, high dependency. Visiting hours are 12 till 4, 6 till 8. "All right, is it? I gotta go. I only want to let you know, in case you want to see her. Bye."
The line went dead. Crystal lowered the mobile from her ear, staring at the screen. She pressed a button repeatedly with her thumb until she saw the word blocked. Her aunt had withheld her number. Crystal walked back to Nikki and Leanne. They knew at once that something was wrong.
"Go and see her,"
said Nikki, checking the time on her own mobile.
"You get there for 2, get the bus."
"Yeah," said Crystal blankly. She thought of fetching her mother, of taking her and Robbie to go and see Nana Kath too, but there had been a huge row a year before, and her mother and Nana Kath had had no contact since. Crystal was sure that Terry would take an immense amount of persuading to go to the hospital, and was not sure that Nana Kath would be happy to see her. "It's serious. They're saying she might not recover."
"Have you got enough cash?"
said Leanne, rummaging in her pockets as the three of them walked up the road towards the bus stop.
"Yeah,"
said Crystal, checking.
"It's only a quid up the hospital, isn't it?"
They had time to share a cigarette before the number 27 arrived. Nikki and Leanne waved her off as though she were going somewhere nice. At the very last moment, Crystal felt scared and wanted to shout, "Come with me." But then the bus pulled away from the curb, and Nikki and Leanne were already turning away, gossiping. The seat was prickly, covered in some old, smelly fabric. The bus trundled onto the road that ran by the precinct and turned right into one of the main thoroughfares that led through all the big-name shops. Fear fluttered inside Crystal's belly like a fetus. She had known that Nana Kath was getting older and frailer, but somehow, vaguely, she had expected her to regenerate, to return to the heyday that had seemed to last so long, for her hair to turn black again, her spine to straighten, and her memory to sharpen like her caustic tongue. She had never thought about Nana Kath dying, always associating her with toughness and invulnerability. If she had considered them at all, Crystal would have thought of the deformity to Nana Kath's chest, and the innumerable wrinkles crisscrossing her face as honourable scars sustained during her successful battle to survive. Nobody close to Crystal had ever died of old age. Death came to the young in her mother's circle, sometimes even before their faces and bodies had become emaciated and ravaged. The body that Crystal had found in the bathroom when she had been 6 had been of a handsome young man, as white and lovely as a statue. Well, that was how she remembered him. But sometimes she found the memory confusing and doubted it. It was hard to know what to believe. She'd often heard things as a child that adults later contradicted and denied. She could have sworn that Terry had said, "It was your dad." But then much later, she had said, "Don't be so silly, your dad's not dead, he's in Bristol, isn't he?" So Crystal had had to try to reattach herself to the idea of Banger, which was what everybody called the man they said was her father. But always, in the background, there had been Nana Kath. She had escaped foster care because of Nana Kath, ready and waiting in Pagford, a strong, if uncomfortable, safety net. Swearing and furious, she had swooped, equally aggressive to Terry and to the social workers, and taken her equally angry great-granddaughter home. Crystal did not know whether she had loved or hated that little house in Hope Street. It was dingy and it smelt of bleach. It gave you a hemmed-in feeling. At the same time, it was safe, entirely safe. Nana Kath would only let approved individuals in through the door. There were old-fashioned bath cubes in a glass jar on the end of the bath. What if there were other people at Nana Kath's bedside when she got there? She would not recognize half her own family, and the idea that she might come across strangers tied to her by blood scared her. Terry had several half-sisters, products of her father's multiple liaisons, whom even Terry had never met. But Nana Kath tried to keep up with them all, doggedly maintaining contact with the large, disconnected family her sons had produced. Occasionally, over the years, relatives Crystal did not recognize had turned up at Nana Kath's while she was there. Crystal thought that they eyed her askance and said things about her under their voices to Nana Kath. She pretended not to notice and waited for them to leave, so that she could have Nana Kath to herself again. She especially disliked the idea that there were any other children in Nana Kath's life. "Who are they?" Crystal had asked Nana Kath when she was 9, pointing jealously at a framed photograph of 2 boys in Paxton High uniforms on Nana Kath's sideboard.
"Them's 2 of my great-grandsons," said Nana Kath. "That's Dan, and that's Ricky. They're your cousins."
Crystal did not want them as cousins, and she did not want them on Nana Kath's sideboard.
"And who's that?"
she demanded, pointing at a little girl with curly golden hair.
"That's my Michael's little girl, Rhiannon, when she were 5. Beautiful, weren't she? But she went and married some wog," said Nana Kath.
There had never been a photograph of Robbie on Nana Kath's sideboard.
"You don't even know who the father is, do you, you whore? I'm washing my hands of you. I've had enough, Terry. I've had it. You can look after it yourself."
The bus trundled on through town, past all the Sunday afternoon shoppers. When Crystal had been small, Terry had taken her into the centre of Yarville nearly every weekend, forcing her into a pushchair long past the age when Crystal needed it, because it was so much easier to hide nicked stuff with a pushchair. Push it down under the kids' legs, hide it under the bags and the basket under the seat. Sometimes Terry would go on tandem shoplifting trips with the sister she spoke to, Cheryl, who was married to Shane Tully. Cheryl and Terry lived 4 streets away from each other in the fields and petrified the air with their language when they argued, which was frequently. Crystal never knew whether she and her Tully cousins were supposed to be on speaking terms or not, and no longer bothered keeping track. But she spoke to Dane whenever she ran across him. They had shagged once, after splitting a bottle of cider out on the wreck when they were 14. Neither of them had ever mentioned it afterwards. Crystal was hazy on whether or not it was legal, doing your cousin. Something Nicky had said made her think that maybe it wasn't. The bus rolled up the road that led to the main entrance of Southwest General and stopped 20 yards from an enormous, long, rectangular grey and glass building. There were patches of neat grass, a few small trees, and a forest of signposts. Crystal followed 2 old ladies out of the bus and stood with her hands in her tracksuit pockets, looking around. She had already forgotten what kind of ward Danielle had told her Nana Kath was on, and she recalled only the number 12. She approached the nearest signpost with a casual air, squinting at it almost incidentally. It bore line upon line of impenetrable print, with words as long as Crystal's arm and arrows pointing left, right, diagonally. Crystal did not read well. Being confronted with large quantities of words made her feel intimidated and aggressive. After several surreptitious glances at the arrows, she decided that there were no numbers there at all, so she followed the 2 old ladies towards the double glass doors at the front of the main building. The foyer was crowded and more confusing than the signposts. There was a bustling shop, which was separated from the main hall by floor-to-ceiling windows. There were rows of plastic chairs, which seemed to be full of people eating sandwiches. There was a packed cafe in the corner, and a kind of hexagonal counter in the middle of the floor, where women were answering inquiries as they checked their computers. Crystal headed there, her hands still in her pockets.
"Where's Ward 12? Crystal asked one of the women in a surly voice.
"Third floor," said the woman, matching her tone. Crystal did not want to ask anything else out of pride, so she turned and walked away, until she spotted lifts at the far end of the foyer and entered one going up. It took her nearly 15 minutes to find the ward. Why didn't they put up numbers and arrows, not these stupid long words? But then, walking along a pale green corridor with her trainers squeaking on the linoleum floor, someone called her name.
Crystal?
It was her Aunt Cheryl, big and broad in a denim skirt and tight white vest with banana yellow black-rooted hair. She was tattooed from her knuckles to the tops of her thick arms and wore multiple gold hoops like curtain rings in each ear. There was a can of Coke in her hand.
She ain't bothered then, said Cheryl.
Her bare legs were planted firmly apart like a sentry guard.
Who?
Terry. She didn't want to come.
She don't know yet. I ain't just heard. Danielle called and told me.
Cheryl ripped off the ring pull and slurped Coke, her tiny eyes sunken in a wide, flat face that was mottled like corned beef, scrutinizing Crystal over the top of the can.
I told Daniel to call you when it happened. 3 days she were lying in the house and no one fucking found her. The state of her. Fucking hell.
Crystal did not ask Cheryl why she herself had not walked the short distance to Foley Road to tell Terry the news. Evidently the sisters had fallen out again. It was impossible to keep up.
Where is she?
Asked Crystal. Cheryl led the way, her flip-flops making a slapping noise on the floor.
Hey, she said as they walked. I had a call from a journalist about you.
Did you?
She gave me a number.
Crystal would have asked more questions, but they had entered a very quiet ward, and she was suddenly frightened. She did not like the smell. Nana Kath was almost unrecognizable. One side of her face was terribly twisted, as though the muscles had been pulled with a wire. Her mouth dragged to one side, even her eye seemed to droop. There were tubes taped to her, a needle in her arm. Lying down, the deformity in her chest was much more obvious. The sheet rose and fell in odd places, as if the grotesque head on its scrawny neck protruded from a barrel. When Crystal sat down beside her, Nana Kath made no movement. She simply gazed. One little hand trembled slightly.
She ain't talking, but she said your name twice last night,
Cheryl told her, staring gloomily over the rim of her can. There was a tightness in Crystal's chest. She did not know whether it would hurt Nana Kath to hold her hand. She edged her own fingers to within a few inches of Nana Kath's, but let them rest on the bedspread.
Rhiannon's been in, said Cheryl, and John and Sue. Sue's trying to get hold of Anne-Marie.
Crystal's spirits leapt.
Where is she?
She asked Cheryl.
Somewhere out Frenchy way. You know she's got a baby now.
Yeah, I heard, said Crystal. What was it?
Dunno, said Cheryl, swigging Coke.
Someone at school had told her,
Hey, Crystal, your sister's up the duff.
She had been excited by the news. She was going to be an auntie, even if she never saw the baby. All her life, she had been in love with the idea of Anne-Marie, who'd been taken away before Crystal was born, spirited into another dimension, like a fairy tale character, as beautiful and mysterious as the dead man in Terry's bathroom. Nana Kath's lips moved.
What?
Said Crystal, bending low, half scared, half elated.
Do you want something, Nana Kath?
Asked Cheryl, so loudly that whispering guests at other beds stared over. Crystal could hear a wheezing, rattling noise, but Nana Kath seemed to be making a definite attempt to form a word. Cheryl was leaning over, one hand gripping the metal bars at the head of the bed.
Said
Nana Kath.
What?
Said Crystal and Cheryl together. The eyes had moved millimeters, roomy, filmy eyes, looking at Crystal's smooth young face, her open mouth, as she leaned over her great-grandmother, puzzled, eager and fearful.
Ellen,
said the cracked old voice.
She don't know what she's saying, Cheryl shouted over her shoulder at the timid couple visiting at the next bed. 3 days left on the fucking floor, it's not surprising, is it?
The tears had blurred Crystal's eyes. The ward with its high windows dissolved into white light and shadow. She seemed to see a flash of bright sunlight on dark green water, fragmented into brilliant shards by the splashing rise and fall of oars.
"Yeah,"
she whispered to Nana Kath.
"Yeah, I goes rowing, Nana."
But it was no longer true, because Mr. Fairbrother was dead.
6. "The fuck have you done to your face? Come off that bike again?" asked Fats.
"No," said Andrew. "Sci-Pi hit me. I was trying to tell the stupid cunt he'd got it wrong about Fairbrother."
He and his father had been in the woodshed, filling the baskets that sat on either side of the wood burner in the sitting room. Simon had hit Andrew round the head with a log, knocking him into the pile of wood, grazing his acne-covered cheek.
"Do you think you know more about what goes on than I do, you spotty little shit? If I hear you breathed a word of what goes on in this house, I haven't. I'll fucking skin you alive, do you hear me? How do you know Fairbrother wasn't on the fiddle too, eh? And the other fucker was the only one dumb enough to get caught."
And then, whether out of pride or defiance, or because his fantasies of easy money had taken too strong a hold on his imagination to become dislodged by facts, Simon had sent in his application forms. Humiliation, for which the whole family would surely pay, was a certainty. Sabotage. Andrew brooded on the word. He wanted to bring his father crashing down from the heights to which his dreams of easy money had raised him, and he wanted to do it, if at all possible, for he preferred glory without death, in such a way that Simon would never know whose manoeuvrings had brought his ambitions to rubble. He confided in nobody, not even Fats. He told Fats nearly everything, but the few omissions were the vast topics, the ones that occupied nearly all his interior space. It was one thing to sit in Fats's room with hard-ons and look up girl-on-girl action on the internet, quite another to confess how obsessively he pondered ways of engaging Gaia Borden in conversation. Likewise, it was easy to sit in the cubbyhole and call his father a cunt, but never would he have told how Simon's rages turned his hands cold and his stomach queasy. But then came the hour that changed everything. It started with nothing more than a yearning for nicotine and beauty. The rain had passed off at last, and the pale spring sun shone brightly on the fish-scale dirt on the school bus windows as it jerked and lurched through the narrow streets of Pagford. Andrew was sitting near the back, unable to see Gaia, who was hemmed in at the front by Sukhvinder and the fatherless Fairbrother girls, newly returned to school. He had barely seen Gaia all day and faced a barren evening with only stale Facebook pictures to console him. As the bus approached Hope Street, it struck Andrew that neither of his parents was at home to notice his absence. 3 cigarettes that Fats had given him resided in his inside pocket, and Gaia was getting up, holding tightly to the bar on the back of the seat, readying herself to descend, still talking to Sukhvinder Jawanda. "Why not? Why not?" So he got up too, swung his bag over his shoulder, and when the bus stopped, walked briskly up the aisle after the 2 girls as they got out. "See you at home," he threw out to a startled Paul as he passed. He reached the sunny pavement and the bus rumbled away. Lighting up, he watched Gaia and Sukhvinder over the top of his cupped hands. They were not heading towards Gaia's house in Hope Street, but ambling up towards the square. Smoking and scowling slightly in unconscious imitation of the most unself-conscious person he knew, Fats, Andrew followed them, his eyes feasting on Gaia's copper-brown hair as it bounced on her shoulder blades, the swing of her skirt as her hips swayed beneath it. The 2 girls slowed down as they approached the square, advancing towards Mollison and Lowe, which had the most impressive facade of them all, blue and gold lettering across the front and 4 hanging baskets. Andrew hung back. The girls paused to examine a small white sign pasted to the window of the new cafe, then disappeared into the delicatessen. Andrew walked once around the square, past the Black Cannon and the George Hotel, and stopped at the sign. It was a hand-lettered advertisement for weekend staff. Hyper-conscious of his acne, which was particularly virulent at the moment, he knocked out the end of his cigarette,
put the long stub back into his pocket and followed Gaia and Sukhvinder inside. The girls were standing beside a little table piled high with boxed oatcakes and crackers, watching the enormous man in the deerstalker behind the counter talking to an elderly customer. Gaia looked around when the bell over the door tinkled.
"Hi," Andrew said, his mouth dry.
"Hi," she replied. Blinded by his own daring, Andrew walked nearer, and the school bag over his shoulder bumped into the revolving stand of guides to Pagford and traditional West Country cooking. He seized the stand and steadied it, then hastily lowered his bag.
"You after a job?"
Gaia asked him quietly, in her miraculous London accent.
"Yeah," he said. "You?"
She nodded.
"Flag it up on the suggestion page, Eddie," Howard was booming at the customer. "Post it on the website, and I'll get it on the agenda for you. Pagford Parish Council, all one word, .co.uk/suggestion page, or follow the link." "Pagford," he reiterated slowly as the man pulled out paper and a pen with a quivering hand. "Parish."
Howard's eyes flicked over the three teenagers waiting quietly beside the savoury biscuits. They were wearing the half-hearted uniform of winter down, which permitted so much laxity and variation that it was barely a uniform at all, unlike that of St. Anne's, which comprised a neat tartan skirt and a blazer. For all that, the white girl was stunning, a precision-cut diamond set off by the plain Jawanda daughter, whose name Howard did not know, and a mouse-haired boy with violently erupted skin. The customer creaked out of the shop. The bell tinkled.
"Can I help you?" Howard asked, his eyes on Gaia.
"Yeah," she said, moving forwards. "About the jobs." She pointed at the small sign in the window.
"Ah, yes," said Howard, beaming. His new weekend waiter had let him down a few days previously, thrown the cafe over for Yarville and a supermarket job. "Yes, yes. Fancy waitressing, do you? We're offering minimum wage, 9 to 5:30 Saturdays, 12 to 5:30 Sundays, opening 2 weeks from today, training provided. How old are you, my love?"
She was perfect. Perfect. Exactly what he'd been imagining. Fresh-faced and curvy. He could just imagine her in a figure-hugging black dress with a lace-edged white apron. He would teach her to use the till and show her around the stockroom. There would be a bit of banter, and perhaps a little bonus on days when the takings were up. Howard sidled out from behind the counter and, ignoring Sukhvinder and Andrew, took Gaia by the upper arm and led her through the arch into the dividing wall. There were no tables and chairs there yet, but the counter had been installed, and so had a tiled black and cream mural on the wall behind it, which showed the square in yesteryear. Crinolined women and men in top hats swarmed everywhere. A brougham carriage had drawn up outside a clearly marked Mollison and Lowe, and beside it was the little cafe, the Copper Kettle. The artist had improvised an ornamental pump instead of the war memorial. Andrew and Sukhvinder were left behind, awkward and vaguely antagonistic to each other.
"Yes, can I help you?"
A stooping woman with a jet-black bouffant had emerged from out of a back room. Andrew and Sukhvinder muttered that they were waiting, and then Howard and Gaia reappeared in the archway. When he saw Maureen, Howard dropped Gaia's arm, which he had been holding absent-mindedly while he explained to her what a waitress's duties would be.
"I might have found her some more help for the kettle, Mo," he said.
"Oh, yes,"
said Maureen, switching her hungry gaze to Gaia.
"Have you got experience?"
But Howard boomed over her, telling Gaia all about the delicatessen and how he liked to think it was a bit of a Pagford institution, a bit of a landmark.
35 years it's been," said Howard, with a majestic disdain of his own mural. "The young lady's new to town, Mo," he added.
"And you two are after jobs as well, are you?"
Maureen asked Sukhvinder and Andrew. Sukhvinder shook her head. Andrew made an equivocal movement with his shoulders, but Gaia said, with her eyes on the girl, "Go on, you said you might." Howard considered Sukhvinder, who would most certainly not appear to advantage in a tight black dress and frilly apron, but his fertile and flexible mind was firing in all directions. A compliment to her father, something of a hold over her mother, an unasked favour granted. There were matters beyond the purely aesthetic that ought perhaps to be considered here.
"Well, if we get the business we're expecting, we could probably do with two," he said, scratching his chins with his eyes on Sukhvinder, who had blushed unattractively.
"I don't," she said, but Gaia urged her. "Go on, together." Sukhvinder was flushed, and her eyes were watering.
"I..."
"Go on," whispered Gaia.
"I..."
"All right."
"We'll give you a trial then, Miss Jawanda," said Howard.
Doused in fear, Sukhvinder could hardly breathe. What would her mother say?
"And I suppose you're wanting to be pot boy, are you?"
Howard boomed at Andrew. "Pot boy?"
"It's heavy lifting we need, my friend," said Howard,
while Andrew blinked at him, nonplussed. He had only read the large type at the top of the sign.
"Pallets into the stockroom, crates of milk up from the cellar, and rubbish bagged up at the back. Proper manual labour. Do you think you can handle that?"
"Yeah," said Andrew. Would he be there when Gaia was there? That was all that mattered.
"We need you early. 8 o'clock, probably. We'll say 8 till 3 and see how it goes. Trial period of 2 weeks."
"Yeah, fine," said Andrew.
"What's your name?"
When Howard heard it, he raised his eyebrows.
"Is your father Simon? Simon Price?"
"Yeah." Andrew was unnerved. Nobody knew who his father was, usually. Howard told the two girls to come back on Sunday afternoon, when the till was to be delivered, and he would be at liberty to instruct them. Then, though he showed an inclination to keep Gaia in conversation, a customer entered, and the teenagers took their chance to slip outside. Andrew could think of nothing to say once they found themselves on the other side of the tinkling glass door. But before he could marshal his thoughts, Gaia threw him a careless, "Bye," and walked away with Sukhvinder. Andrew lit up the second of Fats's 3 fags. This was no time for a half-smoked stub, which gave him an excuse to remain stationary while he watched her walk away into the lengthening shadows. "Why do they call him Peanut, that boy?" Gaia asked Sukhvinder once they were out of earshot of Andrew. "He's allergic," said Sukhvinder. She was horrified at the prospect of telling Parminder what she had done. Her voice sounded like someone else's. "He nearly died at St. Thomas's. Somebody gave him one hidden in a marshmallow." "Oh," said Gaia. "I thought it might be because he had a tiny dick." She laughed, and so did Sukhvinder, forcing herself, as though jokes about penises were all she heard day in, day out. Andrew saw them both glance back at him as they laughed. I knew they were talking about him. The giggling might be a hopeful sign. He knew that much about girls anyway. Grinning at nothing but the cooling air, he walked off, school bag over his shoulder, cigarette in his hand, across the square towards Church Row, and thence to 40 minutes of steep climbing up out of town to Hilltop House. The hedgerows were ghostly pale with white blossom in the dusk. Blackthorn blooming on either side of him, celandine fringing the lane with tiny, glossy, heart-shaped leaves. The smell of the hedgerow, the deep pleasure of the cigarette, and the promise of weekends with Gaia. Everything blended together into a glorious symphony of elation and beauty as Andrew puffed up the hill. The next time Simon said, "Got a job, pizza face," he would be able to say yes. He was going to be Gaia Borden's weekend workmate. And, to cap it all, he knew at last exactly how he might plunge an anonymous dagger straight between his father's shoulder blades.
7. Once the first impulse of spite had worn off, Samantha bitterly regretted inviting Gavin and Kay to dinner. She spent Friday morning joking with her assistant about the dreadful evening she was bound to have, but her mood plummeted once she had left Carly in charge of over-the-shoulder boulder holders, a name that had made Howard laugh so hard the first time he had heard it that it had brought on an asthma attack, and which had made Shirley scowl whenever it was mentioned in her presence. Driving back to Pagford ahead of the rush hour, so that she could shop for ingredients and start cooking, Samantha tried to cheer herself up by thinking of nasty questions to ask Gavin. Perhaps she might wonder aloud why Kay had not moved in with him,
That would be a good one.
Walking home from the square with bulging Mollison and Lowe carrier bags in each hand, she came across Mary Fairbrother beside the cash point machine in the wall of Barry's bank.
Mary, hi, how are you?
Mary was thin and pale, with grey patches around her eyes. Their conversation was stilted and strange. They had not spoken since the journey in the ambulance, barring brief, awkward condolences at the funeral.
I've been meaning to drop in, Mary said. You were so kind and I wanted to thank Miles.
No need, Samantha said awkwardly.
Oh, but I'd like to.
Oh, but then please do. After Mary had walked away, Samantha had the awful feeling that she might have given the impression that that evening would be a perfect time for Mary to come round. Once home, she dropped the bags in the hall and telephoned Miles at work to tell him what she had done. But he displayed an infuriating equanimity about the prospect of adding a newly widowed woman to their foursome.
I can't see what the problem is, really, he said. Nice for Mary to get out.
But I didn't say we were having Gavin and Kay over.
Mary likes Gav, said Miles. I wouldn't worry about it.
He was, Samantha thought, being deliberately obtuse, no doubt in retaliation for her refusal to go to Sweet Love House. After she had hung up, she wondered whether to call Mary to tell her not to come that evening, but she was afraid of sounding rude and settled for hoping that Mary would find herself unequal to calling in after all. Stalking into the sitting room, she put on Libby's boy band DVD at full volume so that she would be able to hear it in the kitchen, then carried the bags through and set to work preparing a casserole and her fallback pudding, Mississippi mud pie. She would have liked to buy one of Mollison and Lowe's large gatto to save herself some work, but it would have got straight back to Shirley, who frequently intimated that Samantha was over-reliant on frozen food and ready meals. Samantha knew the boy band DVD so well by now that she was able to visualize the images matching the music blaring through to the kitchen. Several times that week, while Miles was upstairs in his home study or on the telephone to Howard, she had watched it again. When she heard the opening bars of the track where the muscular boy walked with his shirt flapping open along the beach, she went through to watch in her apron, absent-mindedly sucking her chocolatey fingers. She had planned on having a long shower while Miles laid the table, forgetting that he would be late home because he had to drive into Yarville to pick up the girls from St. Anne's. When Samantha realized why he had not returned and that their daughters would be with him when he did, she had to fly around to organize the dining room herself, then find something to feed Lexi and Libby before the guests arrived. Miles found his wife in her work clothes at 7:30, sweaty, cross, and inclined to blame him for what had been her own idea. 14-year-old Libby marched into the sitting room without greeting Samantha and removed the disc from the DVD player.
Oh, good, I was wondering what I'd done with that, she said. Why is the TV on? Have you been playing it?
Sometimes Samantha thought that her younger daughter had a look of Shirley about her. I was watching the news, Libby. I haven't got time to watch DVDs. Come through. Your pizza's ready. We've got people coming round.
Frozen pizza again? Miles, I need to change. Can you mash the potatoes for me? Miles!
But he had disappeared upstairs, so Samantha pounded the potatoes herself, while her daughters ate at the island in the middle of the kitchen. Libby had propped the DVD cover against her glass of Diet Pepsi and was ogling it.
Mickey's so lush, she said, with a carnal groan that took Samantha aback. But the muscular boy was called Jake. Samantha was glad they did not like the same one.
Loud and confident Lexi was jabbering about school. A machine gun torrent of information about girls whom Samantha did not know, with whose antics and feuds and regroupings she could not keep up.
All right, you two, I've got to change. Clear away when you're done, all right?
She turned down the heat under the casserole and hurried upstairs. Miles was buttoning up his shirt in the bedroom, watching himself in the wardrobe mirror. The whole room smelt of soap and aftershave.
Everything under control, hun?
Yes, thanks. So glad you've had time to shower, spat Samantha, pulling out her favourite long skirt and top, slamming the wardrobe door.
You could have one now.
They'll be here in 10 minutes.
I won't have time to dry my hair and put on makeup. She kicked off her shoes. One of them hit the radiator with a loud clang.
When you've finished preening, could you please go downstairs and sort out drinks?
After Miles had left the room, she tried to untangle her thick hair and repair her makeup. She looked awful. Only when she'd changed did she realize that she was wearing the wrong bra for her clinging top. After a frantic search, she remembered that the right one was drying in the utility room. She hurried out onto the landing, but the doorbell rang. Swearing, she scuttled back to the bedroom. The boy band's music was blaring out of Libby's room. Gavin and Kay had arrived on the dot of 8 because Gavin was afraid of what Samantha might say if they turned up late. He could imagine her suggesting that they'd lost track of time because they were shagging, or they must have had a row. She seemed to think that one of the perks of marriage was that it gave you rights of comment and intrusion over single people's love lives. She also thought that her crass, uninhibited way of talking, especially when drunk, constituted trenchant humour.
"Hello, hello, hello," said Miles, moving back to let Gavin and Kay inside. "Come in, come in. Welcome to Casa Mollison."
He kissed Kay on both cheeks and relieved her of the chocolates she was holding.
"For us? Thanks very much. Lovely to meet you properly at last. Gav's been keeping you under wraps for far too long."
Miles shook the wine out of Gavin's hand, then clapped him on the back, which Gavin resented.
"Come on through. Sam will be down in a mo. What'll you have to drink?"
Kay would ordinarily have found Miles rather smooth and overfamiliar, but she was determined to suspend judgment. Couples had to mix with each other's circles and manage to get along in them. This evening represented significant progress in her quest to infiltrate the lairs of his life to which Gavin had never admitted her, and she wanted to show him that she was at home in the Mollison's big, smug house, that there was no need to exclude her anymore. So she smiled at Miles, asked for a red wine, and admired the spacious room with its stripped pine floorboards, its overcushioned sofa, and its framed prints.
"Been here for, getting on 14 years, said Miles, busy with the corkscrew. "You're down on Hope Street, aren't you? Nice little houses. Some great fixer-upper opportunities down there."
Samantha appeared, smiling without warmth. Kay, who had previously seen her only in an overcoat, noted the tightness of her orange top, beneath which every detail of her lacy bra was clearly visible. Her face was even darker than her leathery chest. Her eye makeup was thick and unflattering, and her jangling gold earrings and high-heeled golden mules were, in Kay's opinion, tarty. Samantha struck her as the kind of woman who would have raucous girls' nights out and find strippograms hilarious and flirt drunkenly with everyone else's partner at parties.
"Hi there," said Samantha. She kissed Gavin and smiled at Kay.
"Great, you've got drinks. I'll have the same as Kay, Miles."
She turned away to sit down, having already taken stock of the other woman's appearance. Kay was small-breasted and heavy-hipped, and had certainly chosen her black trousers to minimize the size of her bottom. She would have done better, in Samantha's opinion, to wear heels, given the shortness of her legs. Her face was attractive enough, with even-toned olive skin, large dark eyes, and a generous mouth, but the closely cropped boy's hair and the resolutely flat shoes were undoubtedly pointers to certain sacrosanct beliefs. Gavin had done it again. He'd gone and picked another humourless, domineering woman who would make his life misery.
"So," said Samantha brightly, raising her glass, "Gavin and Kay."
She saw with satisfaction Gavin's hangdog wince of a smile, but before she could make him squirm more or weasel private information out of them both to dangle over Shirley's and Maureen's heads, the doorbell rang again. Mary appeared fragile and angular, especially beside Miles, who ushered her into the room. Her T-shirt hung from protruding collarbones.
"Oh," she said, coming to a startled halt on the threshold.
"I didn't realise you were having..."
"Gavin and Kay just dropped in," said Samantha a little wildly. "Come in, Mary, please. Have a drink."
"Mary, this is Kay," said Miles. "Kay, this is Mary Fairbrother."
"Oh," said Kay, thrown. She had thought that it would only be the four of them. "Yes, hello."
Gavin, who could tell that Mary had not meant to drop in on a dinner party and was on the point of walking straight back out again, patted the sofa beside him. Mary sat down with a weak smile. He was overjoyed to see her. Here was his buffer. Even Samantha must realize that her particular brand of prurience would be inappropriate in front of a bereaved woman. Plus, the constrictive symmetry of a foursome had been broken up.
"How are you?" he said quietly. "I was going to give you a ring, actually. There have been developments with the insurance."
"Haven't we got any nibbles, Sam?" asked Miles.
Samantha walked from the room, seething at Miles. The smell of scorched meat met her as she opened the kitchen door.
"Oh, shit, shit, shit."
She had completely forgotten the casserole, which had dried out. Desiccated chunks of meat and vegetables sat, forlorn survivors of the catastrophe, on the singed bottom of the pot. Samantha sloshed in wine and stock, chiseling the adhering bits off the pan with her spoon, stirring vigorously, sweating in the heat. Miles's high-pitched laugh rang out from the sitting room. Samantha put on long-stemmed broccoli to steam, drained her glass of wine, ripped open a bag of tortilla chips and a tub of hummus, and upended them into bowls. Mary and Gavin were still conversing quietly on the sofa when she returned to the sitting room, while Miles was showing Kay a framed aerial photograph of Pagford and giving her a lesson in the town's history. Samantha set down the bowls on the coffee table, poured herself another drink, and settled into the armchair, making no effort to join either conversation. It was awfully uncomfortable to have Mary there. With her grief hanging so heavily around her, she might as well have walked in trailing a shroud. Surely, though, she would leave before dinner. Gavin was determined that Mary should stay. As they discussed the latest developments in their ongoing battle with the insurance company, he felt much more relaxed and in control than he usually did in Miles and Samantha's presence. Nobody was chipping away at him or patronizing him, and Miles was absolving himself temporarily of all responsibility for Kay.
"And just here, just out of sight," Miles was saying, pointing to a spot 2 inches past the frame of the picture, "you've got Sweet Love House, the Fawley place. Big Queen Anne Manor House, dormers, stone quoins. Stunning. You should visit. It's open to the public on Sundays in the summer. Important family locally, the Fawleys."
"Stone quoins, important family locally. God, you are an arse, Miles." Samantha hoisted herself out of her armchair and returned to the kitchen. Though the casserole was watery, the burnt flavour dominated. The broccoli was flaccid and tasteless, the mashed potatoes cool and dry. Past caring, she decanted it all into dishes and slammed it down on the circular dining room table.
"Dinner's ready,"
she called at the sitting room door. "Oh, I must go," said Mary, jumping up. "I didn't mean to..."
"No, no, no,"
said Gavin, in a tone that Kay had never heard before, kindly and cajoling. "It'll do you good to eat. Kids'll be all right for an hour."
Miles added his support, and Mary looked uncertainly towards Samantha, who was forced to add her voice to theirs, then dashed back through into the dining room to lay another setting. She invited Mary to sit between Gavin and Miles, because placing her next to a woman seemed to emphasize her husband's absence. Kay and Miles had moved on to discussing social work.
"I don't envy you," he said, serving Kay a large ladle full of casserole.
Samantha could see black, scorched flecks in the sauce spreading across the white plate.
"Bloody difficult job."
"Well, we're perennially under-resourced," said Kay, "but it can be satisfying, especially when you feel you're making a difference." And she thought of the Whedons. Terry's urine sample had tested negative at the clinic yesterday, and Robbie had had a full week in nursery. The recollection cheered her, counterbalancing her slight irritation that Gavin's attention was still focused entirely on Mary, that he was doing nothing to help ease her conversation with his friends.
"You've got a daughter, haven't you, Kay?"
"That's right, Gaia. She's 16.
"Same age as Lexi. We should get them together," said Miles.
"Divorced?" asked Samantha, delicately. "No," said Kay. "We weren't married. He was a university boyfriend, and we split up not long after she was born."
"Yeah, Miles and I had barely left university ourselves," said Samantha.
Kay did not know whether Samantha meant to draw a distinction between herself, who had married the big, smug father of her children, and Kay, who had been left. Not that Samantha could know that Brendan had left her. "Gaia's taken a Saturday job with your father, actually," Kay told Miles, "at the new cafe." Miles was delighted. He took enormous pleasure in the idea that he and Howard were so much part of the fabric of the place that everybody in Pagford was connected to them, whether as a friend or a client, customer or employee. Gavin, who was chewing and chewing on a bit of rubbery meat that was refusing to yield to his teeth, experienced a further lowering in the pit of his stomach. It was news to him that Gaia had taken a job with Miles's father. Somehow he had forgotten that Kay possessed in Gaia another powerful device for anchoring herself to Pagford. When not in the immediate vicinity of her slamming doors, her vicious looks and caustic asides, Gavin tended to forget that Gaia had any independent existence at all, that she was not simply part of the uncomfortable backdrop of stale sheets, bad cooking and festering grudges against which his relationship with Kay staggered on.
"Does Gaia like Pagford?" Samantha asked.
"Well, it's a bit quiet compared to Hackney," said Kay, "but she's settling in well." She took a large gulp of wine to wash out her mouth after disgorging the enormous lie. There had been yet another row before leaving tonight. "What's the matter with you?" Kay had asked, while Gaia sat at the kitchen table, hunched over her laptop, wearing a dressing gown over her clothes. 4 or 5 boxes of dialogue were open on the screen. Kay knew that Gaia was communicating online with the friends she had left behind in Hackney, friends she had had, in most cases, since she'd been in primary school.
"Gaia?"
Refusal to answer was new and ominous. Kay was used to explosions of bile and rage against herself, and particularly Gavin.
"Gaia, I'm talking to you. I know, I can hear you. Then kindly have the courtesy to answer me back."
Black dialogue jerked upwards in the boxes on the screen, funny little icons, blinking and waggling.
"Gaia, please, will you answer me?"
"What? What do you want?"
"I'm trying to ask about your day." "My day was shit. Yesterday was shit. Tomorrow will be shit as well."
"When did you get home?"
"The same time I always get home."
Sometimes, even after all these years, Gaia displayed resentment at having to let herself in, at Kay not being at home to meet her like a storybook mother.
"Do you want to tell me why your day was shit?"
"Because you dragged me to live in a shithole." Kay willed herself not to shout. Lately, there had been screaming matches that she was sure the whole street had heard.
"You know that I'm going out with Gavin tonight."
Gaia muttered something Kay did not catch.
"What?"
"I said I didn't think he liked taking you out."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
But Gaia did not answer. She simply typed a response into one of the scrolling conversations on the screen. Kay vacillated, both wanting to press her and afraid of what she might hear.
"We'll be back around midnight, I expect."
Gaia had not responded. Kay had gone to wait for Gavin in the hall.
"Gaia's made friends," Kay told Miles, "with a girl who lives in this street. What's her name? Narinda?"
"Sukhvinda," said Miles and Samantha together.
"She's a nice girl," said Mary.
"Have you met her father?"
Samantha asked Kay.
"No," said Kay.
"He's a heart surgeon,"
said Samantha, who was on her 4th glass of wine.
"Absolutely bloody gorgeous."
"Oh," said Kay.
"Like a Bollywood film star."
None of them, Samantha reflected, had bothered to tell her that dinner was tasty, which would have been simple politeness, even though it was awful. If she wasn't allowed to torment Gavin, she ought at least to be able to needle Miles.
"Vikram's the only good thing about living in this godforsaken town, I can tell you," said Samantha. "Sex on legs."
"And his wife's our local GP," said Miles, "and a parish councillor. You'll be employed by Yarville District Council, Kay, are you?"
"That's right," said Kay, "but I spend most of my time in the fields. They're technically in Pagford Parish, aren't they?"
"Not the fields," thought Samantha. "Oh, don't mention the bloody fields."
"Ah," said Miles, with a meaningful smile. "Yes, well, the fields do belong to Pagford, technically. Technically they do. Painful subject, Kay."
"Really?"
Why?
Asked Kay, hoping to make conversation general because Gavin was still talking in an undertone to the widow.
Well, you see, this is back in the 50s.
Miles seemed to be embarking on a well-rehearsed speech.
Yarville wanted to expand the Cantermill estate, and instead of building out to the west, where the bypass is now...
Gavin, Airy, more wine,
Samantha called over Miles.
They were a little bit duplicitous. Land was bought without it being very clear what they wanted it for, and then they went and expanded the estate over the border into Pagford Parish.
Why aren't you mentioning old Aubrey Fawley, Miles?
Asked Samantha. She had at last reached that delicious point of intoxication where her tongue became wicked and she became disengaged from fear of consequences, eager to provoke and to irritate, seeking nothing but her own amusement.
The truth is that old Aubrey Fawley, who used to own all those lovely stone quoits or whatever Miles was telling you about, did a deal behind everyone's backs.
That's not fair, Sam, said Miles, but she talked over him again.
He flogged off the land where the fields are built, pocketed, I don't know, must have been a quarter of a mil or so.
Don't talk rubbish, Sam, back in the 50s.
But then, once he'd realised everyone was pissed off with him, he pretended he hadn't known it would cause trouble, upper-class twit, and a drunk,
added Samantha.
Simply not true, I'm afraid, Miles said firmly. To fully understand the problem, Kay, you need to appreciate a bit of local history.
Samantha, holding her chin in her hand, pretended to slide her elbow off the table in boredom. Though she could not like Samantha, Kay laughed, and Gavin and Mary broke off their quiet conversation.
We're talking about the fields,
said Kay, in a tone intended to remind Gavin that she was there, that he ought to be giving her moral support. Miles, Samantha and Gavin realised simultaneously that the fields was a most tactless subject to raise in front of Mary when they had been such a bone of contention between Barry and Howard.
Apparently they're a bit of a sore subject locally, said Kay,
wanting to force Gavin to express a view, to rope him in.
Hmm,
he replied, and turning back to Mary, he said, So, how's Declan's football coming on? Kay experienced a powerful stab of fury. Mary might be recently bereaved, but Gavin's solicitousness seemed unnecessarily pointed. She had imagined this evening quite differently, a foursome in which Gavin would have to acknowledge that they were really a couple. Yet nobody looking on would imagine that they enjoyed a closer relationship than acquaintanceship. Also, the food was horrible. Kay put her knife and fork together with three quarters of her helping untouched, an act that was not lost on Samantha, and addressed Miles again. Did you grow up in Pagford?
Afraid so,
said Miles, smiling complacently.
Born in the old Kelland Hospital along the road. They closed it in the 80s.
And you?
Kay asked Samantha, who cut across her.
God, no, I'm here by accident.
Sorry, I don't know what you do, Samantha, asked Kay.
I've got my own biz...
She sells outsized bras, said Miles.
Samantha got up abruptly and went to fetch another bottle of wine. When she returned to the table, Miles was telling Kay the humorous anecdote, doubtless intended to illustrate how everyone knew everyone in Pagford, of how he had been pulled over in the car one night by a policeman who turned out to be a friend he had known since primary school. The blow-by-blow reenactment of the banter between himself and Steve Edwards was tediously familiar to Samantha. As she moved around the table, replenishing all the glasses, she watched Kay's austere expression. Evidently, Kay did not find drink driving a laughing matter.
So Steve's holding out the breathalyzer, and I'm about to blow in it, and out of nowhere, we both start cracking up. His partner's got no idea what the hell's going on. He's like this.
Miles mimed a man turning his head from side to side in astonishment.
And Steve's bent double, pissing himself because all we can think of is the last time he was holding something steady for me to blow into, which was nigh on 20 years ago, and...
It was a blow-up doll,
said Samantha, unsmilingly dropping back into her seat beside Miles.
Miles and Steve put it in their friend Ian's parents' bed during Ian's 18th birthday party. Anyway, in the end, Miles was fined a grand and got 3 points on his license because it was the second time he'd been caught over the limit, so that was hysterically funny.
Miles's grin remained foolishly in place, like a limp balloon forgotten after a party. A stiff little chill seemed to blow through the temporarily silent room. Though Miles struck her as an almighty bore, Kay was on his side. He was the only one at the table who seemed remotely inclined to ease her passage into Pagford's social life.
"I must say, the fields are pretty rough," she said, reverting to the subject with which Miles seemed most comfortable and still ignorant that it was in any way inauspicious within Mary's vicinity. "I've worked in the inner cities. I didn't expect to see that kind of deprivation in a rural area, but it's not all that different from London, less of an ethnic mix, of course."
"Oh, yes, we've got our share of addicts and wasters," said Miles. "I think that's about all I can manage, Sam," he added, pushing his plate away from him with a sizable amount of food still on it. Samantha started to clear the table. Mary got up to help.
"No, no, it's fine, Mary, you relax," Samantha said.
To Kay's annoyance, Gavin jumped up too, chivalrously insisting on Mary's sitting back down, but Mary insisted.
"That was lovely, Sam," said Mary, in the kitchen, as they scraped most of the food into the bin. "No, it wasn't, it was horrible," said Samantha, who was only appreciating how drunk she was now that she was on her feet. "What do you think of Kay?"
"I don't know, she's not what I expected," said Mary.
"She's exactly what I expected," said Samantha, taking out plates for pudding. "She's another Lisa, if you ask me."
"Oh, no, don't say that," said Mary. "He deserves someone nice this time." This was a most novel point of view to Samantha, who was of the opinion that Gavin's wetness merited constant punishment. They returned to the dining room to find an animated conversation in progress between Kay and Miles, while Gavin sat in silence. "Offload responsibility for them, which seems to me to be a pretty self-centred and self-satisfied..."
"Well, I think it's interesting that you use the word responsibility," said Miles, "because I think that goes to the very heart of the problem, doesn't it? The question is, where exactly do we draw the line?"
"Beyond the fields, apparently," Kay laughed with condescension. "You want to draw a line neatly between the home-owning middle classes and the lower..."
"Pagford's full of working-class people, Kay. The difference is, most of them work. Do you know what proportion of fields lives off benefits? Responsibility, you say? What happened to personal responsibility? We've had them through the local school for years. Kids who haven't got a single worker in the family. The concept of earning a living is completely foreign to them. Generations of non-workers, and we're expected to subsidise them."
"So, your solution is to shunt off the problem onto Yarville," said Kay, "not to engage with any of the underlying..."
"Mississippi mud pie?" called Samantha.
Gavin and Mary took slices with thanks. Kay, to Samantha's fury, simply held out her plate as though Samantha were a waitress, her attention all on Miles. "The drug clinic, which is absolutely crucial and which certain people are apparently lobbying to close."
"Oh, well, if you're talking about Bellchapel," said Miles, shaking his head and smirking, "I hope you've mugged up on what the success rates are, Kay. Pathetic, frankly, absolutely pathetic. I've seen the figures, I was going through them this morning, and I won't lie to you, the sooner they close..."
"And the figures you're talking about are?"
"Success rates, Kay. Exactly what I said, the number of people who have actually stopped using drugs, gone clean."
"I'm sorry, but that's a very naive point of view. If you're going to judge success purely..."
"But how on earth else are we supposed to judge an addiction clinic's success?" demanded Miles, incredulous. "As far as I can tell, all they do at Bellchapel is dole out methadone, which half of their clients use alongside heroin anyway."
"The whole problem of addiction is immensely complicated," said Kay, "and it's naive and simplistic to put the problem purely in terms of users and non..." But Miles was shaking his head, smiling. Kay, who had been enjoying her verbal duel with this self-satisfied lawyer, was suddenly angry.
"Well, I can give you a very concrete example of what Bellchapel's doing. One family I'm working with, mother, teenage daughter and small son, if the mother wasn't on methadone, she'd be on the streets trying to pay for her habit, and the kids are immeasurably better off."
"They'd be better off away from their mother, by the sound of it," said Miles.
"And where exactly would you propose they go?"
"A decent foster home would be a good start," said Miles.
"Do you know how many foster homes there are against how many kids there are needing them?" asked Kay.
The best solution would have been to have had them adopted at birth.
Fabulous! I'll hop in my time machine, retorted Kay.
Well, we know a couple who are desperate to adopt, said Samantha, unexpectedly throwing her weight behind Miles. She would